from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon says around 50% of all robberies in the city last year were stolen smartphones. He wants phone companies to install a kill switch that renders a phone inoperable after it has been stolen. And Apple announced on Monday that it would be the first smartphone manufacturer to do so. Gascon, a former San Francisco police chief, joins us to talk about cell phone theft as well as his views on immigration reform, crime in the Bay Area, and other issues. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. And on Thursday, San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon and New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman will meet with a number of phone manufacturers for a smartphone summit brought on by an increasing number of robberies of smartphones, many of them violent thefts. The district attorney and his New York AG summit co-sponsor have been trying to bring pressure to bear on phone manufacturers to create technology with a so-called kill switch that would render a phone inoperative after it has been stolen. On Monday, Apple announced that it would be the first smartphone maker to do just that. And District Attorney Gascon, the nation's first police chief to become a district attorney, joins us for this Forum Hour to discuss this issue and his hopes for the upcoming summit, as well as a range of other issues. And good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael. Good to see you.
Good to see you again. And let's begin with this summit. I mean, the rising number of what they're calling Apple pickings, these thefts, it's not just Apple, because I know you're meeting in the summit with a number of manufacturers, but Apple says they've got the cure.
You know, we're hopeful. And when I say we, I'm also including Eric in this. I mean, we have been working together, as well as many other people in law enforcement. I have to say that across the nation, and certainly here, Chief Sert has been a strong proponent of what we're trying to do. But I don't believe it's quite a kill switch. We don't understand fully all the functionalities, and I'm hoping that we will get a better understanding during this summit tomorrow in New York City. But I think that there's still work to be done. Certainly, Samsung is also talking about announcing some technological development July 1st that will go also towards making these phones a better user experience when it comes to thievery. But there's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
Well, we don't want to get too bogged down in technology here, but because it can get pretty complicated. But Apple actually announced at the Worldwide Development Conference that they had something that would require users to use their password to turn it off or to turn off the application. I mean, they're saying essentially that that they have this in operation and it's going to be harder to use or sell a stolen phone.
Yeah, and again, I want to remain very optimistic, and I think that certainly the Apple is representing is a good step forward. It's still not very clear to us. You know, what would occur if you go into another country, you start using other networks? What would happen if you can you use Wi-Fi configuration? You know, there's still a lot of questions. And I can tell you that, you know, Apple is being very careful. They're certainly not calling it a kill switch. And I think there's a reason why they're not doing that also. If you look at the very brief information that they're providing, they talk about making it harder to be stolen and, you know, reused. But they're being very guarded in the way they describe what they're providing. So, I'm hoping that we will get more clarity as to the functionality, and that certainly this is a step in the right direction. I have to tell you that earlier this year, Apple was not willing to have much of a conversation. So we have come a long way in a very short period of time.
Well, the fact of the matter is there's an economic incentive, some might say, for manufacturers, and some have said this. Phone is stolen, and then somebody has to buy another phone.
Well, I tell you, absolutely, there's an economic incentive for the carriers in the U.S. You know, for the carriers in the U.S., when a phone gets stolen, you have to go out and get another phone. Generally, in the business model for the U.S., what you're doing is the phone is subsidized by the carrier, so you extend your contract, which means that they continue to keep you hooked for a significant period of time. It shortens the replacement cycle of the phone. I think for the manufacturer, it's more nuanced because the phones often get exported to other nations. And that's, you know, that's impacting their market in those other nations. But certainly for the U.S. carriers, it's a windfall.
Well, you look at some of the numbers, 1.5 million smartphone thefts and back in 2012, lost and stolen cell phones cost approximately, by some standards, $30 billion last year. I mean, it's staggering numbers. And the thievery and the kind of robberies that are attached to smartphones, we're talking about a national epidemic, aren't we?
Well, we are. I mean, if you look at San Francisco, for instance, last year, 50% of all the robberies involve a mobile communication device. There were people that were injured as a result of this. Obviously, there's a huge economic cost. You look at New York City, there have been two or three murders that are attributed to cell phone robberies. Here in our own city, about 6 weeks ago, we had a tourist that was cut up pretty badly.
Was there a kid in a church, too?
There was a kid in the church also that was the victim. He or she was holding the phone for – she actually – was holding the phone for mom. So, you know, the impact on the victims is tremendous. The economic impact on the criminal justice system and the fact that we're subsidizing these carriers and these manufacturers that are making a lot of money. This is a $60 billion industry a year in the U.S. alone. It's huge. And then, you know, there is the other piece of it that often is not spoken to. But the reality that also we have young men usually coming from poor socioeconomic backgrounds that view these phones as an easy way to pick up a few $100s, and they don't understand the significant consequences. The fact is here, robbery is a strike, and we're seeing a lot of 16, 17-year-old men very early in their life picking up a strike, and the consequences of that over an extended period of time can be significant to the individual, the community, and the entire system.
So you'll be in New York tomorrow with the New York Attorney General, and I guess it's your hope that you'll be holding some feet to the fire?
Absolutely. Attorney General Schneiderman and I are very committed on this. We both understand the need for some social responsibility on the part of the industry, and we're going to work hard to make sure that that occurs.
There's also some public awareness that could help here, too. I mean, just people, for example, not being so visible with their phones. They're all walking on the street and texting and so forth, which is dangerous in its own right. But I was reading some statistics that most of these thefts occur somewhere between 7 and 10 p.m.
Yes, and you're absolutely right, Michael. The, you know, public awareness and prevention is key to success here. The problem is that no matter how hard we try to, you know, engage in prevention activities, these mobile communication devices are becoming so much part of our life. You know, we're conducting businesses, we're walking, we're certainly socializing. So it is hard for people not to use these devices when they're walking, when they're using public transportation. Unfortunately, some people do it when they're driving, and obviously that's absolutely a no-no. But yes, prevention is important, but I think this is one of the few areas in the criminal justice system where a technological solution can have a tremendous impact.
Talk a little bit about how the genesis of this, I mean, this alliance with the New York Attorney General. You got coast to coast. How did you two come together?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, we, independent of one another, we were working on the same things. And it became pretty obvious to us as we were looking at the media and what's going on with the cell phone issues. I started working on this last year. He had been working on it. And we realized that we would probably be much more effective working together once we recognized that we both had a passion for the same things. And that's how this came together.
Talking again with District Attorney George Gascon, and we wanted to cover a number of issues with the District Attorney this morning. I want to talk about remember reading the piece that you wrote in the Huffington Post on immigration, and because it's so current now, the Gang of Eight has essentially moved things along. They're moving along in the Senate, and it's likely that we'll have an immigration bill of some kind. There are going to be a lot of amendments. They're already talking, in fact, about the borders. And in this piece, you talked about your own experiences coming here from Cuba and being in Mason, Arizona as a police chief and going face-to-face with Sheriff Arpaio. Arpaio, yeah. I want to get you on record here just in terms of where you stand on this, because we've got 11 million people who you see as, how shall I put this, who should be on a path to citizenship.
I agree 100%, and I made that clear not only in the most recent op-ed piece that I wrote, but I have, for several years. I think that we have a social problem in this country that is not getting any better. You know, we have not only this 11 million people that are here, and frankly, most of them are here to stay. But there is the extended family, their neighborhoods. There's so many other people that get impacted by this group. There is also an economic reality that we have to face up to. The reason why this 11 million people are here is because there has been a huge appetite for unauthorized labor in this country. We have entire industries that are depending on this, and that has had a very negative impact, a very depressing impact on labor here in the U.S. And one of the ways to cure that is to regularize our labor systems and make sure that we have a thoughtful immigration process. There's also been a tremendous impact on our criminal justice system. We have criminalized good people over, you know, immigration that is driven purely by economic needs, both in both sides of the border.
Not only criminalized, but you point out in your article, dehumanized. Even the word illegal, you say, is a kind of, race crime in a way.
Well, absolutely. And you know, and that is one of the unfortunate byproducts of this whole thing, is that for those that have really engaged in the anti-immigration movement, you know, they have done a tremendous job in dehumanizing people because it's very easy to go after people that we somehow think that they're somewhat lesser than we are, right? And a lot of that has gone on. So obviously that has complicated the dialogue. You know, one of my concerns now, quite frankly, during this whole immigration debate is the whole concept that we have to secure the borders before we can allow people to be regularized, which I think is a horrible argument on many levels. For one thing, I'm not sure what securing the borders means. You know, you can keep moving that that goalpost and never achieve it. The reality is that our borders are more secure today under the Obama administration than they have ever been. We have engaged in more deportations in the last 5 years that we've had in our entire history. So that the whole argument of securing the borders and, you know, standing online, all these arguments that you hear are really somewhat hollow when you actually start peeling the onion and you get to the bottom of it.
I think you say in the article they are kind of a ruse to impede immigration reform, but this is what we're hearing now with the bill in the Senate. We're hearing, especially out of Texas, and we need amendments for more secure borders. There's also, I mean, and you point to xenophobia and so forth. I mean, the article certainly, in fact, what kind of response did you get to that article?
You know, it's really interesting. Every time that I write these articles, and this is not the first time that I come up with things that some people may consider controversial, is that usually the responses are about split evenly. People, they think, hey, you know, you're the most thoughtful guy since, you know, since sliced pie was invented or whatever. And then you get the other people that they have a very visceral reaction to it, you know, that what are you talking about, you know. So it's probably a good thing. You know, part of my reasoning for writing this piece is because I think it's important to get a very robust dialogue on this issue and uncover things for what they are.
What do you say, though, to, and, you know, I've heard this through the years, and it may even come up in this morning's program, because people have visceral reactions, of course, to the whole question of path to citizenship and legalizing what they think of as illegal or unlawful. I mean, here you are, legal officer, and how can you sanction, you know, people coming into the country, breaking our laws? They talk about rule of law, and then allow them to go on a path that that essentially exonerates them or immunizes them from what they broke in terms of our law.
Yeah, I think, you know, the problem is that the questions are much more complex than that. First of all, I think it's important to go back in our history and see what the path of citizenship has been throughout the last few generations. The reality is that we have a lot of people that talk about lawful entry into this country today, but when their grandfathers or their, you know, their parents came to this country, it was a completely different reality, right? There were people that were arriving to New York not that long ago, really, only a little over 100 years ago, and they were being picked up by political buses and taken to participate in local elections, and they clearly were not necessarily lawful citizens or certainly anybody that would qualify to vote. So, you know, we seem to forget the history of this country is a history of immigration. We also seem to forget that the reason why we have so many people in this country today that are here unlawfully is because we have this incredible thirst for a labor pool that we do not possess, that we do not have. In fact, today, if you talk to many of the growers in the state, they would tell you that they're hitting a crisis mode. There is actually growers that are moving their operations south of the border because there are not enough people coming from Mexico to come and work our fields today, which to me, that's a very troubling pattern because the reality is that if you want to talk about homeland security, one of the most important components of us maintaining a secure secureness to our nation is to be able to control our food supply. And increasingly, we're going to see our food supply maybe being provided by others. So we have that problem already with energy. Now we're likely to have the same problem in the next 20 or 30 years. The other part of it is that, you know, Mexico probably in the next 30 to 40 years will be stopped exporting labor. You know, demographically, Mexico is not growing the same way that it had in the last several decades.
And we have Alberto Cruchado on recently, who said probably immigration is going to stop because it's Alfredo Cruchado essentially taking the position. He's the head of the Dallas Bureau who covers Mexico for them. But notwithstanding what you've just hit on, I mean, the history, the appetite for workers and so forth, what about just the central argument that breaking our laws, it diminishes the force of the law or the rule of law to not essentially to scan over that?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's important to recognize that the laws have to have a connection to reality, right? This country engaged, for instance, in experimentation with prohibition, right? And that was an unrealistic experimentation, and that created, you know, a tremendous amount of unlawfulness and a lot of crime. In the last 2.5 decades or so, we engaged in a war on drugs. We have also criminalized huge portions of our population over this whole area of the war on drugs. You know, the laws have to be thoughtfully crafted.
Maybe the laws have to be changed.
And laws have to be changed sometimes.
Talking again with District Attorney George Gascon. And San Francisco, you want to remain, have it remain a sanctuary city?
I do. I think it's important for local authorities to stay out of the immigration fray. And the reason for that is because we want to make sure that the people that are living here feel comfortable using local services. There is a health component to it. There is a public safety component to it. Just think about our restaurants. Think about the kitchens in our restaurants. Who are working in those kitchens? Do we want to make sure that these people, for instance, have access to health care? Or do we not care whether the people that are working in our kitchens today have communicable diseases and no place to go? Do we want the folks that are living here and are working here to be able to avail themselves of public safety services? You know, you start moving down the line, and all these are things that are extremely important to the sustainability and the health of our community, regardless of whether you're here with authority or not.
And what about your position? I assume it's the same with respect to undocumented youth who are arrested as opposed to being turned over to ICE or the like?
I believe that undocumented youth present even a greater challenge for us, right? This were people that came here because their parents brought them over. You know, they're really a product of circumstances that were completely beyond their control. And I think that we have to be very thoughtful in the way that we deal with this population. And that doesn't mean that we have to be soft on crime. There are some of these young kids that have committed some very serious crimes, and they need to face the consequences appropriately. But having said that, it's very important to recognize that this population is also a very different population.
If you've just joined us, we're talking to District Attorney of San Francisco, George Gascon, and we'll give you an opportunity certainly to speak with District Attorney Gascon. I want to cover a number of things here, though. You hired the first chief information officer, and you have been actually pretty bullish on technology, $320,000 for a new database. It's an idea that came, I guess, originally from Bill Bratlin. We might talk a bit about the expense of what Oakland spent for his advice. But what about the new technology? I mean, do you feel that it's moving forward? Because there's been a lot of criticism. You know, you stopped attendance from becoming statistics by turning them into statistics, that you don't – prosecutors will not use this in terms of the narrative and the real personal stories and so forth. They'll just be looking at crunching numbers. Let's hear you on this.
Yeah, you know, I think, first of all, let me just say our technology is not even moving fast enough. We need to continue to move forward. Technology is about using...
We're not in the 70s anymore.
We're not in the 70s, but we're not quite in this current century as well. I think we're still in the latter part of the 20th century. But this is about using evidence-based practices. The reality is that, especially in the prosecutorial world, we have operated for many years on intuition. We have operated on emotions. You know, our entire penal code is a result of emotion-driven laws, by and large, especially when you look at the sentencing schemes that we often use. There is no connection between the levels of incarceration in this country and public safety. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to begin the conversation of using evidence-based practices so that we guide our practice, we inform what we do based on appropriate, well-developed risk assessment tools that not only look at the crime but are also looking at the individual. And we're trying to figure out what are the outcomes that would better serve the victim, the community, and the offender over a long period of time, as opposed to simply looking at an offense-based process where we're extremely risk-adverse, and generally the default button is going to be always seeking higher and higher levels of punishment, which often translates into extended periods of incarceration without any connection whatsoever to whether that makes us safer or not.
What about a program like Joan Peters Cilia's, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where she talks about doing this internally, that is, for public defenders, for probation department, for community-based organizations, as opposed to prosecutors using this essentially for the prosecution. One of the things, in fact, just to append to that for a moment, that used to concern me as an interlocutor who would lead debates, for example, between Terry Hallinan and Kamala Harris back in the day, was this metric that was always applied to district attorneys in terms of how many prosecutions do you have? And as an elected official, you have to have that in mind.
I do, but I have to tell you that that is probably one of the most damaging metrics that have been used in American prosecutions for generations, right? The number of convictions, the number of cases that you try really has no reflection at all on whether you're being effective in providing for the safety of your community. But let me go back to Joan. Actually, Joan and I are friends. I have a tremendous amount of respect for her. As a matter of fact, we were sharing a meeting on Monday, and Joan and I are actually exploring ways of working together with others to develop the kind of systems that I'm talking about. I think that we both share a passion.
You're not mutually exclusive of each other.
They're not, absolutely, yes.
You're talking about prosecutions. We did a program that you might have heard about red light running, and it's dreadful. I mean, you know, in terms of the number of prosecutions, police have expressed the fact that they just don't necessarily even feel that they can get these kind of prosecutions through, that they can that they're being, in other words, that they're achieving the success rate that they would like to have in terms of these being, and people are afraid in terms of pedestrian safety and all that sort of thing. I'm sure you're acutely aware of this, but is this a problem from this kind of metric standpoint? Because they're so hard to prosecute?
Oh, you know what? I don't think so. I think that, again, one of the problems and why things are hard to prosecute is because we are looking at the entire thing through a very traditional lens of the way that business has been done for a very long time. You know, one of the things that I've done in the office is increasingly we've taken a lot of cases away from the court system and we're putting them in our neighborhood courts, for instance. And we have seen a tremendous amount of success. You know, we run almost 700 cases last year. We're on pace to increase that number. We're now going to create a similar process later in the summer for juveniles, where we're going to create a restorative justice model for juveniles, again, which will be outside the criminal justice process. I think that we just need to re-engineer and redefine the role of prosecution in this country, and we need to be focused on providing safety and not equating incarceration levels with safety, because they really are not equal. As a matter of fact, if you look at our recidivism rate, nearly 70%. What that means to me is that we're failing about 70% of the time, and you cannot say that that is a successful system.
Let me give out the phone number. You can join us with George Gascon if you have questions or comments. We welcome you. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny, San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon with us this hour. He says around 50% of all robberies in the city of San Francisco last year were stolen smartphones, and he wants cell phone companies to install a kill switch that renders a phone inoperable after it is stolen. Apple announced on Monday that it would be the first manufacturer to do so. The district attorney has some skepticism, which he's expressed here. He's a former San Francisco police chief. He's with us to talk about that as well as other issues, immigration reform, crime in the Bay Area, and so forth. And we certainly welcome your involvement. You can Communicate with us with your questions or comments by going to our website, of course, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment, or by tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. And you can also go to our Facebook page, but feel free to call us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. George Gascon, when you came into office, you made some promises about truancy, about helping vulnerable victims and reducing violent crime, and the numbers are certainly better on that score. But there are sort of, to use the word you've used a couple of times, more nuanced kind of issues like creating safer neighborhoods. What have we done to create safer neighborhoods?
Yeah, you know, as a matter of fact, several things. Number one, the creation of the neighborhood courts process is all about engaging local neighborhood stakeholders into the criminal justice system at the ground level. And we're beginning to see some good responses from that. The other things that we have done is that we have moved our victim services into the community. So traditionally, victim services were always handled out of the Hall of Justice. And given my experience in policing, I knew that a lot of people will not come to the Hall of Justice, usually the most vulnerable victims. So we started to move our victim services. We started on the Mission and the Bayview. We're now in the Tenderloin. We're also in Chinatown, and we're continuing to expand that program. And that is an area that really works very aggressively towards creating higher capacity in our neighborhoods. The other thing that we're doing is that we're actually working and trying to get federal grants that would help us work on victimization. I theorize, and I believe that others will support me, that one of the best ways to create safer and more sustainable communities is actually working with victims of crime very early on and trying to reduce victimization. What we see often, especially in our more crime-ridden neighborhoods, is that the levels of victimization are impacting the psyche of the community in very bad ways. We have young people that are being exposed to high levels of violence very early in their life, and that is damaging them psychologically, it's damaging them physically. You know, if you look at the mortality rate, for instance, of young people that are raised in some of those neighborhoods, is significantly higher, both as a young man or a young person as well, in terms of their ability to live a long life as compared to the rest of us. So those are the things that we're engaging in the office. So there's some short-term stuff, but there are some real exciting long-term stuff that we believe that would yield tremendous results. We're working with a school district. We've started a pilot program a year and a half ago in Burton High School, working with at-risk kids that were coming out of middle school into high school, with already tremendous signs of evidence that they would be the kids that are more likely to drop out of school. We have shown tremendous success in this area. We want to take that citywide.
What is it you're doing to keep them in school or to make them want to go to school?
Yeah, so what we have done with this in this particular case is that we identify the cohort of kids that had basically all the factors that indicate that they would not be successful in high school, you know, their grade levels, their attendance, and some other issues. In order to be able to work with them without having to have problems with, you know, information access, we got parental consent to work with these kids. And then working with CARC, which is a community-based organization that deals with youth-related issues, we actually took funding out of my office to fund a couple of attendance counselors. We work with the principal in order to identify the kids as they were coming in and assess their academic standing on the different levels, ensure that they were being provided with the right level of assistance in order to be successful academically, ensuring that they were coming to school to the point that actually if they would be late, you know, like a half hour late, the call would be there immediately to ensure that they were showing up for school. Because one of the things that is really obvious to me, especially coming from a former high school dropout, that the best way to be successful in school is, first of all, is you got to show up. You can't be successful if you're not there. So we have seen a significant improvement in their attendance and their grade performance. At the more macro level, we have been dealing with our big truancy efforts that had started under Kamala Harris. And we have continued to expand that process. And I think that if you look at the numbers, especially attendance in the San Francisco Unified School District, and you compare in the last 5 years, it's just really increased. astronomically, and a lot of that has to do with the work that started with CAMEL and that we have continued to do. So there's a lot of things that are going on that are showing tremendous results.
Getting back to safer neighborhoods for a moment, then I want to get to our callers here. You had a bete noir before the last election, a guy named Randy Shaw, who wrote in Beyond Cron and talked about you as the invisible DA and all that sort of thing. But he also said he kept kind of harping on the fact that you had made promises to reduce public drug activity in the upper area of the Tenderloin, also really talking about Turk Street for the most part, I guess, and the Mission area. And essentially, he kind of was beating the hobby horse that not enough was being done, that you kind of were absent, I guess. Invisible was his word.
Well, you know, I think that sometimes people will certainly have their own ideology on the way that they want to conduct business. I don't believe that lowering drug use in the Tenderloins should be driven by increased incarceration and arrest, right? So what we're trying to do is we're trying to do things very differently. We now have neighborhood prosecutors at every station, which includes the Tenderloin station. We're working very closely with the police officers. We're working very closely with many other stakeholders. We're trying to get people into services. And I believe that there is a much more promising approach to dealing with drug problems on our street than it is enforcement-based. And I'm not saying that enforcement should not be a part of it, but I think it cannot be the driving force. And I think that the problem with people like Randy is that they want to have it both ways. If there would be too many arrests, he would be criticizing me because I'm criminalizing drug use. Not enough arrests, then I'm invisible. Unfortunately, he hasn't seen me in many of our neighborhood meetings, and certainly the fact that we have a neighborhood prosecutor that works in that neighborhood every day. But, you know, again, you know, a lot of the stuff is in the eyes of the beholder. But I think that the proof is in the total numbers and what's going on. I think that, you know, we're making inroads in areas that we weren't before.
I should mention Randy Shaw is executive director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic and also believes in services. But one other thing, I guess, that comes up when we're talking about those who have criticized your performance during your last campaign, your opponent, David Onick, accused the office, your office, of excessive secrecy. Specifically, he said you refused to release police-involved shooting records, which span 2000 to 2010. Are you now making this information public?
As a matter of fact, that was one of the things that I said that I would do. I said that I would not go retroactively, that I would do it moving forward from the time that I took office, and we have. And anyone that is has a curiosity, you can go on the website. We actually post as soon as we finish that information. It's certainly available to anyone. So when we complete an investigation officer-involved shooting, we make the results public, and we have been doing so.
And we'll go to our public and bring in our callers. We begin, Ken, with you. Good morning.
Hi. For District Attorney Chrisson, I had a friend who actually just on Saturday had his cell phone stolen, but he is not here legally, and so he was afraid to go to the police to make any kind of report. And when we called the phone company, they were not any help either, and also actually said that going to the police would be ridiculous because they won't do anything anyway. So I guess my two questions are, one, what would be the ramifications for him if he had placed a report through the police with his illegal status? And then two, it seems like with the GPS, it would be fairly easy if reports were made right away for the police to track down these phone and thieves. Why don't they?
Yes, really good questions, Ken. First of all, let me say that there will be absolutely no immigration consequences to this person for reporting the crime. The San Francisco Police Department, as part of our total city family, does not look at immigration status when a victim comes to report a crime. And I encourage that person, if he or she has any doubts about that, certainly to contact my office and we can help him work with the police department to make the report. It's very important, by the way, that a report be taken, because that allows to not only, hopefully, for the investigation to maybe take us to the people that committed the crime, but more importantly, it gives us a context as to the nature of the crime. And, you know, we're continuously adjusting our strategies, and part of that is understanding the scope of the problem. The second question you have, good question, GPS. The problem with the current phone systems that we have is usually the people who are stealing these phones, they do what is called jailbreaking, which you get into the phone very quickly, you wipe out the entire system, and you basically start with a clean slate. So whatever you had in there and any GPS-equipped stuff that you had, once the phone has been jailbreaked, all that stuff is no longer operable. And the people that are stealing these phones recognize this, and they will do this very, very quickly. In fact, the more proficient ones, usually within 5 to 10 minutes, the phone will be cleaned up. They know that they can put the phone, first of all, they'll put the phone into a metal container or especially designed bag that actually keeps any airwaves from communicating, so it isolates the phone, and then the phone is put through this process where the GPS system that it has is completely invalidated, and at that point the phone can be used by someone else. Put a new SIM card, and you're out to go.
And Ken, we thank you for the call. Actually, I want to stay with smartphones and cell phones for a while. Here's a listener who says, a kill switch is bad for a number of reasons, not least of which is that it means that perfectly functional phones will become useless, which will lead to yet more electronic waste in our environment as thieves dispose of them. The bigger picture is that this kill switch idea is a Trojan horse. What the government ultimately wants is a path to get inside your phone so that they can wiretap it, steal your photos, and so on. Their strategy is to first find a seemingly harmless reason to get their software onto your phone. Then they will add seemingly innocuous updates, which upon analysis turn out to be for wiretapping, stealing, and spying. Now, this is in the wake, of course, of all that's been going on with the NSA and everything. But
I can understand the fear. But actually, let me first of all, kind of walk you through the type of kill switch that we're talking about. Is one that the process would be reversible to the owner, if he or she decided to do so, and there would be several tiers before you actually activate a kill switch. Generally, what we're advocating is that you would wait until the phone is actually being jailbroken, a new SIM card has been put in, so that it's very clear to you that whoever has your phone is not simply misplaced. Now the phone is in someone else's possession, and they intend to use it, and then this process will go on. Number one. Number two, the system will be completely an opt-in process or an opt-out so that those that do not want to be part of the system would not have to be. So it actually is a consumer that will decide whether he or she wants to have the services. And then finally, we obviously want to make sure that we put enough safeguards in there to protect people's identity.
And just to echo what you've been saying about the violence attached to many of these thefts, Casey writes, last August I was jumped by 5 young men in San Francisco who were trying to steal my phone. I ended up fighting them off and keeping my phone, but not before I was severely injured, ended up incurring $35,000 in medical expenses. The amount of violence that is associated with these muggings far outweighs the value of the goods stolen, and I definitely support any technology that decreases the allure to steal smartphones. But Jeffrey says, I'm not sure why this tech approach is hard or even novel. When I lost my employer's BlackBerry, they initiated a poison pill that would make the thing inoperative. This is important because of the protected information on the device. I support Gascon's approach and wonder why this is news.
Yeah, BlackBerry has probably been a little bit ahead of the curve in this because of the tremendous amount of government use for those systems. The problem is that the system has become antiquated. It no longer works very well, and you have the other manufacturers as they move down the technology line to create more functionality to the smartphones. They have not attended to the technology of how to make it more secure. So the listener is absolutely right, and that's why early on when I approached the carriers and even the manufacturers and I was being told that there was no way to create this functionality, I fought back because I knew that that was a disingenuous argument. The reality is that this technology already exists. It's just a matter of having the willpower to upgrade it and implement it in new systems.
And we go to more calls for the District Attorney Gascon. Ken, you're on.
Hey, about pedestrian safety, we know nearly or approximately 1,000 people were hit by cars last year in San Francisco, and that about 25% of all trips made by people in the city are made by walking. So walking's pretty important to San Francisco, and it's a darn dangerous city. What I look for in walking, as someone who walks an hour a day, is to basically know which way cars are going. And there is a safety device we've had that's vastly underutilized called the turn signal or blinker. It's been on all cars since the 1930s, yet in SF, you would die of starvation waiting for someone to use a right turn signal, and now the left turn signal is rarely used. I mean, these are the basic pieces of information that someone needs to know about which way a car is going when they're standing at an intersection trying to cross the street. SFPD simply doesn't enforce this. I mean, nobody gets tickets for this. SFPD itself doesn't use turn signals. And really, when driving, nothing is easier than turning on that signal, and it helps other cars navigate as well as people.
Yeah, Ken, as I've said, we did a program on this, and in fact, I would recommend that you and others who are interested go to our archives. But let me get the district attorney to respond to your...
No, Ken, you're absolutely right, and I like the fact that you also talk about, you know, when you're walking, you're also paying attention to your surroundings. You know, last year we did a campaign late last year that we talk about basically what's the rush, and part of that was showing that, you know, traffic safety in our community is a shared responsibility. Clearly, motorists have to do their part, and part of that is that they have to use signals, and they have to make sure that they're driving at speeds that are safe for the conditions. Obviously, pedestrians have a responsibility as well. We often see people crossing the streets using their mobile communication devices, or, you know, not paying attention to the surrounding. Cyclists also have a responsibility, and absolutely, law enforcement, the police, and the prosecutors, we all play a role. But the reality is that we need to continue to talk about this issue. We are a walking city, as you indicated. About 25% of our trips are walking, which is great for the environment. Quite frankly, it's great for our community health as well. And we just need to come together and recognize that we all share the roads, and no one owns the roads, and that we all have a responsibility to look out for one another.
We thank you for the call, Ken. I want to go to some listener comments all about the sanctuary issue. Here's a listener who writes, the DA's positions on various issues, particularly illegal immigration, paint a clear portrait of what Frisco's law enforcement, Herb Cain used to say, never call us Frisco, what Frisco's law enforcement establishment has to believe in, or at least say, in order to get elected there. The topper is his support for Frisco being a sanctuary city, despite its resulting in the city protecting some truly vicious criminals. The DA's position, Frisco staying out of federal business of immigration law enforcement, in reality has more like obstruction of justice, treating Frisco as some kind of city-state like Singapore. Another listener says, does Mr. Gascon believe there is any problem with being a sanctuary city? He only espouses the benefits but never discusses that there may be problems. Is this because he doesn't believe there are any? And Skip on our Facebook page says, do you support the municipal sanctuary laws passed by the Board of Supervisors back in 1989? Would you favor expanding the sanctuary policy to include deadbeat dads, sex workers, tax cheats, sex offenders, and other lawbreakers? There's a whole passel there. I mean, it's kind of like a trifecta, but you get the sense of...
No, I do. And you know, first of all, let me begin by saying that, you know, when you're looking at public safety, as someone that has been dedicated his entire life basically to working in public safety and making communities safer, my job is to assess what works and what doesn't work. And I can tell you now, having been involved in policing in three major cities, seeing the result of the Arizona approach to immigration, where you have a sheriff that was going after undocumented workers with such a zeal that drove crime underground and people refusing to report, and the impact that had in those communities that were being policed by the sheriff, and also seeing the reverse when you're working in a collaborative fashion with every portion of the community to make a community safer, I can tell you that I believe that my approach is a better one. And the proof to that is on the crime numbers, whether you see my work in Arizona, where I had, in 3 years, we were able to lower crime in the city of Mesa by 30%, while neighboring cities that were being policed by the sheriff's department had their crime going up. Whether you see my initial stages here as a police chief, where we lower homicides to levels that had not been seen since the late 50s, early 60s, and continue to maintain a relatively safe environment in the city, I tell you that based on my professional experience, as a local police chief, or certainly a local police, the entire community benefits when everybody's willing to work with the police. And when you take a major segment of your community and you isolate that community away from public safety, you create a vacuum, and that vacuum will generally be filled by people that will harm not only people that are here without authority, but will harm our entire community. Are there problems with our immigration process? Clearly they are. But the fix is not coming from local police. The fix has to come from a holistic approach, a comprehensive approach to our immigration problem.
Let's bring out another caller. John, join us.
Hey, just to depend on that, let's look across the bay at what Bill Bratton's doing with OPD and their own community-based policing programs, or the South Bay, or to the state that just passed the law saying we're not going to be participating in NDAAs, indefinite detention. But nonetheless, I'm just wondering, I can see your opinion of secure communities on its face, and I'm trying to square that with your support of the immigration bill, because one of the biggest criticisms I see against secure communities is it's inaccurate. It's just targeting the wrong people, and we need to fix that part. But, you know, in the immigration bill, we're going to form a 11 million person biometric database, and especially regarding the NSA leaks that have come out this week. I'm wondering what your opinion is on that provision of the immigration bill, and if you would still, you know, support it if that was included.
Look, you know, the problem with the immigration bill is a reality of living in a democracy, right? This is going to be a product of a compromise. We can get very ideological about it and basically make sure that nothing occurs, or we can work together, get a bill through, begin the process of fixing our immigration process, realizing that we may not be necessarily happy with every portion of the bill. You know, I learned a long time ago that the signs of having a good outcome when it comes to negotiation was when everybody walks from the table with some level of dissatisfaction.
We just had an hour on the budget where that proves to be true once again. And look what happened with the so-called gun reform bill. I mean, it kept getting watered down and watered down and then couldn't even get through the Congress.
Yeah.
An immigration bill may get through because we were talking about this just yesterday of the interest that Republicans have in getting on the side of Hispanics or at least getting that vote.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets down to politics often, really.
Yeah, and it is. And you know, it was funny, but I'm going to digress a little, but I think it really illustrates our political process. I think that anybody, and I'm not sure that it's historically correct, but I think it has some very important points. If you see the movie Lincoln, and the whole process of dealing with slavery, you know, is similar to what we're dealing with in immigration today. Look, you got people that are completely opposed to one another, but there has to be some middle ground. And I think that we will be much better off as a nation creating a path for citizenship and regularization than not. And that's what I support.
And we get another caller on. Paul, that's you. Join us. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing? So I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener, but I have a question to ask for Gaston, Mr. Gaston here, is what about all the break-ins that are happening to cars throughout the city, as well as all the, you know, the junkies that are definitely people who are causing the problems that are very visible throughout the city? What's your plans on doing with that?
Well, you know, the plan to deal with that is the same plan that is to deal with anything else. First of all, let me say that public safety is a shared responsibility, much like traffic safety. So we as a community have to work together.
Have you been a long advocate of community policing still?
I continue to be. You know, I think that's the only way to police a community well. So, you know, you have to have the community has to come together. Obviously, the police department has to work on it. And I'm doing something that, quite frankly, is very unique in prosecutions, is creating the concept of community-based prosecutions. What we have assistant district attorneys that are assigned to every police station. They're working with the community. They're working with the police. And we're trying to look for ways to fix problems. There is no question that there are areas that need to be worked on. The problem with break-ins and vehicles in the city is a problem that has existed for very many years. We are a densely populated city. We have a lot of people living on top of one another. Unfortunately, vehicles do not get garaged. They often park on the streets. So it creates a very target-rich environment. Part of community responsibility on this, quite frankly, is do not leave valuables on areas in your vehicle that are, you know, easily seen. You will hear from police often that the people that, you know, will call to report that the car was broken into, they left a computer, they left a laptop, they left a bag in plain view, and that obviously created that attractive nuisance that certainly helps, you know, people break into the cars. Having said all of that, we clearly have to work together on this, and as we have to work in many other areas to continue to improve the quality of life of our city.
Let me take a caller and an emailer here. Says, while lobbying to get phone companies to put in kill switches is a good long-term project, why not have the police try immediately useful solutions? Stings. It's really a no-brainer. Have police decoys act like dumb tourists talking on phone in areas where there's a high phone thievery.
Yeah, so good point. And the police actually has tried that. In fact, they have gone both ways. They have actually tried to act as somebody not paying attention and see whether they would be robbed. And they have also tried, which I think it might be even a little better approach, is actually try to identify buyers or fence people that are willing to buy stolen phones and then arresting the buyers. All this are partial solutions to the problem. They may take care of some of the issues, but the long-term solution continues to be, in this particular case, is creating a scenario where the phones will have no aftermarket value or no value in the stolen market. But you're absolutely right, and I think that the San Francisco Police Department has been working really hard with very limited resources to try to address the very issue.
Very limited time left, but I want to get to this question from a listener in El Cerrito. John says, please ask DA Gascon why San Francisco has one of the lowest homicide prosecution rates in the state.
I'm not sure where you're getting that from, because actually not only do we prosecute every case where there is an arrest, but actually in the last 2 years, we have actually cleared a lot of old cases, and our conviction rate in homicides is pretty much industry standard, right around 90%. So those numbers that you're mentioning, I think I would urge you to do a little looking into it, because that's actually inaccurate. Anyone that gets arrested for homicide and there's evidence to prosecute the case, they get prosecuted. When I was a chief of police here, we actually brought the solvability rate to homicides to levels that had not been for many years, and we reduced homicides from nearly 100 a year to 47 within 1 year. And since then, the homicide rates here have stayed very low. In fact, I would argue that for a major urban center, we have one of the lowest homicide rates of any major city in the country.
Thank you for joining us this hour. District Attorney George Gascon, and hope things go well with the summit. We'll stay on top of that and try to find out what is accomplished. In the meantime, you still surfing a lot?
No, I haven't. In fact, I got a new board that has been new for about 3 years. That's not a good sign.
Well, we want to tell you that Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Senior editor Dan Zoll, and executive producer Raul Ramirez. And many, many thanks to our star intern, Nora McCartan, who is leaving us. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.